Bill Moseley.
Danielle Harris.
Dick Warlock.
George Romero.
Dane Hodder.
Robert England.
Ronnie Blakely.
And you're listening to
Deep in the Heart of Texas.
With your hosts, Jeff, Nathan, and Ralph.
You gotta be fucking kidding.
Oh, hey, you okay?
You gonna be alright?
I'm feeling rosy, yeah! Oh, what's in the box?
It's black as time.
What's in the fucking box?
Nothing!
Drop the front on this!
Welcome to another special edition episode
of Deep Underwater in Texas.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Jeff.
And this is Ralph.
Well, there he is. The Boomin' from Saloonin'.
Hey, what's up?
God.
Yeah, we're coming live from, deep in the heart of Texas. This is, Project Hurricane Harvey edition. I don't know. we're mid-fucking flood zone. Every one of us is pretty much flooded in to our home, so we're all just kind of calling in, and we're going to talk a little horror for you.
That's dedication, people.
Yeah.
That's dedication you just don't see.
All right, let's get right
Damn
into
dedication.
It. We're monitoring basically our homes being, rendered useless. but, Nate, you're up like, 3-4 in the morning, and you got some really sad news.
Yeah, we got a tornado warning.
No,
I woke up yesterday, 3 a.m., to a tornado warning. My wife made me jump out of bed and out of my skin. And I went online for some unknown reason, and Tobe Hooper had passed away less than an hour before I got up. So another legend, man. The Big Four is only down to like Carpenter, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we lost Ramiro, we lost Craven, now we lost Hooper. I mean, we got Barker and Carpenter, like you said.
Yeah. It's crazy, dude.
Ralph, you said the man was born in 1943. He's he's a Texas native?
Yep. January 25th, 1943. Austin, Texas native, actually.
Oh, wow. Austin. Wow.
Keeping it weird.
Golly. I mean,
and kind of flooded right now too. While we're at it,
and that's deep pride right there. I mean, here we are. He's a Texas native. He contributed probably one of the most awesome, not just Texas,
couple,
yeah, but the Texas Chainsaw Massacre obviously being like top of the list for Mr. Hooper. I mean, that was just cream of the crop. I mean, when I saw that, at such a young age, it had such an impression. I mean, from the John Larroquette introduction.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths, in particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Just solidifying that realism, that dark, I don't know, it was almost faux documentary, but it was so fucking, it was shot so unique. I mean, it really hit these horror notes that, that even when you watch it today, it's like, wow, like this really is a fucking classic. Like when you watch Romero's fucking Night of the Living Dead, you're watching something that's truly essential and unique to the genre.
Yeah, I mean, that, Poltergeist, Salem's Lot, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I mean, the dude had a vision. He wrote Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was kind of like a dark humor comedy, but everybody was so fucking terrified of the film, it just... gave him a career.
No,
100%.
Yeah. And it was also the stepping stone for a lot of upcoming slashers after that.
Totally. Like
it is literally the grandfather of slasher film.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd call that the grandfather and Psycho the grandmother.
No
shit. Yep.
Oh, man.
There you go.
That's so awesome. Hitchcock. I mean, I would love to have seen Hitchcock just sit in a room with Carpenter and all these legends, you know, that the horror legends, you know, because I mean, it's like that is true, like, you know, the Last Supper kind of fucking gentleman that we would like love to see in a room, you know, hopefully. And when we, you know, leave this fucking universe and we go into the void, hopefully that's something that we do get to experience, is seeing these great masterminds just talk shop, you know?
Yeah, that'd be a beautiful picture. Mondo should work on that one.
Yeah.
Instead of the four dogs playing poker, it's me with the three dead directors.
There you go.
Oh, God.
Perfect.
That'd be awesome.
Actually, I'd probably be at the Nirvana table.
There you go.
So who really killed you?
It was Dave Grohl. He wanted to be a Foo Fighter that bad.
Motherfucker. I'd like have Kurt Cobain, the inventor of the Fifi, and
Jesus,
the inventor of the Fleshlight.
And the Pringles man things. Himself, right from the can.
Oh my god. If you people don't get that reference, refer to our last episode.
Oh, I know. I mean, y'all, thank y'all all for tuning into that episode. That is like one of our quickest growing episodes to like be like listened. I don't know if it's just for pure brutal fucking comedic reasons or what, but yeah, we've solidified a strong following for that particular episode.
I'm convinced it was just Heather Langenkamp's apartment neighbors.
Yeah, she's like, you know what, guys, they're talking about me. You have to check it out.
They mentioned me.
It's a podcast. A podcast.
Is she Canadian?
Yes, she stocked up on lavender and dick, so she is now officially a Canadian.
What a boot the bootcast.
Jesus Christ.
So
yeah, I mean, when we're talking about Tobe, I've always wanted to meet the man. I don't know if you ever got to, Jeff. I didn't know if he ever did Texas Frightmare.
He was at 2009 Texas Frightmare, so it was, I think it was 2009.
So you met him?
Yes.
Please elaborate.
Oh, elaborate? It was more like I didn't have the $60 to go and get the autograph, but it was...
So you met him in the VIP room and tried the Thai sauce.
Yes. we tried the Thai sauce. No, I mean, it was a unique, man. I want to say it was 2009. It was TFW. I always get my years mixed up because it was one of the first years I actually got to make it out there. And yeah, dude, it was just cool. Because, I mean, it was like when you walk by Ramiro and stuff, and Argento and Bava, it's like all these directors, Ruggiero and stuff, is like you're meeting and seeing these guys that are true fucking visionaries. And we all knew the myth about the Poltergeist film, like that Steven Spielberg was kind of behind the scenes, kind of mainlining the direction of the film. And Hooper was there to kind of situate the situation. But regardless, Hooper's name has always been invoked in like our mind of like being the sole reason for Poltergeist. And Poltergeist, in my mind, is like it was like our Paranormal Activity for our era. You know, there wasn't anything that captured supernatural the way Poltergeist was able to, you know, just like the way Carpenter was able to invoke Myers for Halloween and stuff like that. Like Poltergeist was like the top of supernatural films, like when we grew up as 80s kids and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it delved deep with one of the, I don't know, primordial ooze catchphrase of pop culture history. They're here.
Exactly.
I mean, yep. That to anybody and everybody knows exactly what the fuck that is.
Oh, yeah. I wish I could cue the music up right now during the episode, but when you hear the Poltergeist theme, you just like, you hear Carol Ann, you see her in your fucking house. The music, the eeriness, I mean, yeah, you know, you start replaying episodes of Coach.
Yeah, for real. You know, I found it funny because I, you know, being that we're going through a hurricane right now, people, we didn't get to research. I mean, we've been sandbagging our houses and, you know, sweeping the water out. But, you know, I still remember parts of this movie so vividly. I found one of the funniest parts is the parents smoke weed in this movie.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
Yep.
Like I always remember this being like a very, like, American pie-ish, you know, Americana kind of film. Like, oh, you know, it's wholesome. But then the parents are, like, fucking sitting in the bedroom toking up while their kids are in bed talking about fucking banging each other. Yeah. It's like, what the fuck?
She's wearing like that little fucking, her underwear and her fucking little jersey shirt. And I was like, oh, man.
It's like, get him, coach.
No shit. It's like, man, coach knows how to score.
Fuck yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Dude, Joe Beth Williams was always hot.
Yeah. But the way the family was handled, the way that, man, Carol Ann, I'm sorry, she knocked it out of the park. I mean, the family dynamic was like what James Wan would make himself known for, is creating atmosphere within the family dynamic. And then you introduce the horror, you know, you bring in the supernatural into this beautifully set, you know, family situation that's really, you can identify with, and it feels comfortable. And then you just tear it apart, you know, in front of the audience.
And listeners, if you're wondering why we're just perusing and we only talked about 3 minutes about Texas Chain, we plan on actually revisiting these and making them a series.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about it.
I can't wait to watch the Poltergeist series again.
Oh, totally.
And especially Texas Chainsaw. Like, we were talking before this call, hey, how are we going to do this without wanting to really elaborate in such legendary movies? And we said, you know what, we're going to peruse it, pay tribute to the man, and we'll get into our next subject. So don't think this is our reviews. We're going to actually revisit these series.
Yeah, we'll cover the series properly.
Correct.
Yep.
Live from my shitter.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre Popper.
Oh, yeah. So
should I let out a snort? Should I?
All right,
so, man. I mean, he went on to do the Salem's Lot, which I find to be like,
that was
probably one of the best incarnations of Dracula on film.
That was like the most. I don't know. They just re-released that. I don't know, like a year ago or something like that on Blu-ray, and it's like the 1979 TV movie of Salem's Lot. Just it's done right. You get it, and it's just immaculate and beautiful to see that something like this could have been created, you know,
for TV. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, I mean, that's some terrifying shit to be airing in 1979.
Because it's already a great novel, and it's like, wow, what Hooper was able to capture, and the styles they use was just it's so timeless. You know, it's great to revisit. It's like Interview with the Vampire and stuff like that. It's like it was done. And it's a standalone, and it's perfect in its own, you know, fractured little way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, such strong performances.
I love the look of Lord Barlow, man.
Oh, yeah.
Kurt Barlow, he looks fucking awesome.
Dude. I mean, everybody. I mean, you could name names from this fucking goddamn show, and unless you're from that time, they mean literally dick to you. But when you look at the film as a whole, it solidifies like an idea of like, wow, this is like vampires and dark towns and stuff done right that King would only emphasize later as he goes through his, exhibition of like, you know, terror, you know, and creation.
Yeah.
The one that always stood out by me that I was always proud to say that, you know, that Hooper had directed was The Funhouse. Because I watched I watched it at such a young age, and when you're exposed to these kids, they go to a carnival, and they go to that dark, like, creepy ride, but the thing is, they break into it, and there's, like, a weird guy that runs it, and then there's, like, literally a Jason Mongoloid that's in costume the whole time that terrorizes him because he wants to sleep with this prostitute. It's such a weird story, but it works for the time. And I was just like, it's just like, wow. Like, when I watch it, I'm just like, wow, this is like so fucking fun and dark and cool. And you're just glad that, you know, like Cooper or Craven, like one of these godfathers is connected to creating that kind of story. I mean, whether it gets a great rap in people's cult classic stuff, I find it to be a really fun film to, go back to and check and catch.
Yeah. What was your introduction, Ralph, to Tobe Hooper?
In all honesty, it was Poltergeist. Poltergeist was my beginning.
Sweet.
With Mr. Hooper, and that's also the movie that got me started on really digging into to the paranormal stuff as well. Like, if any of you guys know, like, I love, like, any kind of, like, ghost hunting movies, any kind of ghost movies, poltergeists, hauntings, you name it. If anything deals with the paranormal, I eat that shit up.
Gotcha.
Like, I'm trying to plan a trip to go back to Louisiana to the Myrtle Plantation and stay there for a couple of nights. I'm trying to. It all depends on finances, of course. But, I love that shit. It's one of my favorites.
And that's why you got the Mario Brothers ghost tattooed on you.
Yep, that's right. I got them. I got Inky Blinky and the other two ghosts from Pac-Man. I got fucking...
There's two on each butt cheek.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm just waiting for Nate to get his Pac-Man tattoo.
So
hell yes, right on the tip.
Power pellet right in the middle.
Oh man. He does this sad face when he like when he breaks down.
Right? Poltergeist was my beginning, and that ranks up there as one of my top favorite horror movies right there.
What's funny about Hooper is, like, I never sought out, like, you go through, like, you know, you go through Carpenter and you guys seek out every Carpenter film to kind of fill out his filmography for yourself. But with Hooper, it was just, like, by chance, every little fucking niche film that I'd seen, like, when I saw Life Force or Funhouse or, you know, you catch these weird off things, like, you know, like Invaders from Mars was always like one of those sci-fi movies that I had seen and left an impression. But then when you go back and you go like, who the fuck did all those movies? And you see Hooper's name on it, you're like, wow, like, that's kind of cool that it just so happened that all these unique films that kind of had a fucking, you know, that chimed in, that stuck out in my brain for like those 80s VHS movies I would rent or watch were Hooper, you know?
Right.
Like, that was weird. In your spectrum of, like, paranormal films, where does Poltergeist land? Like, is there something that, like, does Conjuring kind of take the cake now, or do you still hold Poltergeist as being
No.
No, I still hold Poltergeist in a high regard. Like, I love Conjuring. I love I like the original Ju-on movies. Poltergeist just takes the cake for everybody, you know, like,
is it like?
Yeah, I have all those other ones I really appreciate, but Poltergeist is really like number one.
Is it like the practical effects, like the Ghostbusters kind of practical effects that sold it for you on that one?
Yeah, it's that the just the way that the ghost / demons looked near the end of the movie when they're just trying to get everybody out of there, you know?
Yeah,
and it was just insane. I love those scenes.
And I think it's magic that, like, Spielberg and, like, Hooper and, like, that could have create that kind of situation then. Because, like, the special effects, we weren't CG land, you know? We had to do things in camera. We had to do things in front of the camera. You had to have the right team that created the right lighting effects and stuff. You know, like, when they do that simple room shot, but you see everything spinning and the record starts playing and stuff like that. Or even, like, the clown dynamics with the little boy or the tree coming alive. It's like these...
Yeah.
This film was filled with, like, physical special effects that had such a long, 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 long-lasting effect, you know?
Yeah, real skeletons.
Beautiful. God, that swimming pool. Yeah, like, I'll never look...
Real cadavers.
God, never look at a fucking... a being-made swimming pool the same, you know what I mean?
I can't wait to actually review this series, because I know a lot of information. For me, Poltergeist definitely takes. Oh, fuck, it'd have to be in the top three for horror for, you know, ghost movies. It's funny because I actually remember liking Poltergeist 2 more, but I haven't seen Poltergeist 2 in, God, I don't even know how long.
Yeah, but I
feel isn't that where they introduced the Reverend?
Yeah, and I think that's the reason two stood out so much because of the Reverend story for me.
Be silent now while we're there, we ascend. And then the big Indian chief, the shaman.
Oh, yeah, from fucking what is that? Is it the same dude from One Flew Over as a Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah, I believe it is. Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to review the series, but yeah, Poltergeist is
in the upper echelon for these type of movies. I mean, especially for guys our age, we grew up with it. So like people that were born in, I don't know, 95 may be like a Paranormal Activity type person.
Yeah.
You know, but that's their genre. That's their years of movies. But I mean, fuck, Poltergeist stands firm. You know, that evil tree, the kid's braces coming out of the mirror. I mean, fuck. Oh, there was so much shit in that movie where I was just like, fuck this.
No, when the guy eats a steak and it becomes maggots and then he goes and looks in the mirror and starts peeling his fucking face off.
The kitchen trick still this day scares me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Where she turns around, the chairs are all stacked up. She's like, and just runs. I'm like, holy shit.
Oh,
you know what? It still baffles me that it has a PG rating.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Pot usage, one or two uses of the word fuck, real cadavers, you know, endangered.
Yeah. Drug use.
You know, fucking Craig T. Nelson snorting cocaine off Joe Beth's ass.
God.
You know, that's a lot of crazy things
like
happening.
The coach on Wall Street.
That would be the greatest opening shot for that movie. He's just like, right in his face.
He's blowing coke into her asshole.
Jesus.
Go to sleep, Carolyn!
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man. Did any of y'all catch the Space Vampire 1985 film Life Force with like Steve Railsback? And Steve Railsback always stands out.
I did not.
Okay. Cause it's like,
I did see it, but it's been a long fucking time.
Yeah, it's like butt naked space vampire chick the whole fucking film. And you got Steve Railsback from like X-Files. Like,
ooh.
Yeah, Steve.
Tell me more.
They watched. They waited. Now their time has come. Out of the depths of space, the ultimate terror. Moving, searching, destroying. From body to body, from life to life, from man to woman. Changing, growing, burning for our life force. From the director of Poltergeist, from the special effects creator of Star Trek, The Motion Picture, Life Force. In the blink of an eye, the terror begins.
Well, Steve Railsback, like, oh, you want more about the naked space vampire chick?
Tell me everything.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah, you get pretty much tits and bush the whole fucking time. You know, she's just pretty much literally sucking off the energy of every fucking male.
Sucking off, right?
And she's get a hit off that.
Well, you talk about movies that need to be remade.
Yeah, I know, right? You just get Megan Fox, and you know, in your
no bush,
you're golden.
You're good.
Golly, yeah.
Hey, I hear that.
Hey, we can actually
put that Pringle can up.
We can actually see her vampire wings. Heyo.
Oh,
God, is she in some windy weather?
Harvey, leave me alone.
Next time, and deep in the flaps of Texas.
Oh shit.
Oh, God damn it.
All right, so we press along. I know Nate already mentioned it. Ralph mentioned Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 1. If we fast forward into 86, we have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which is literally, I don't know.
Dynamite.
I don't know where the fuck this came from. Like, this was just lightning in a bottle kind of weird shit. I mean, to escalate the original, which was just pure, straight fucking horror, and then come to this comedy Phantasmo Wonderland that brings Dennis Hopper, Bill Moseley, Caroline Williams. I mean, you have so much work. Bill Johnson taking the Leatherface fucking situation. I mean, there's so much magic that happens in this Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. It's hard to really, you know, put it to words because it was just so unique for its time.
It's one of the reasons I cannot wait to review this series, man. I love Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
If you look at the fucking poster for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, it looks like a family photo.
It's the Breakfast Club.
Literally, right?
Exactly.
You got
they purposely imitated. There you go. That word. They purposely did it like that because, you know, Tobe thought that the first Chainsaw was a comedy. If that's a comedy, bro, then I don't even want to know what your horror is.
No shit.
But, part two, he gave it a little bit more levity. He's like, all right, you know, people aren't understanding what I'm thinking about. So he made it a little funnier, man. And god damn, it's such a great movie with soundtrack by Oingo Boingo. You can't fucking lose. K-O-K-L-A.
So here's a special request we're doing this afternoon and tonight. You steady listeners know we're playing this every hour.
It's a fun.
Yes, we're Lefty.
You got that murder track. You need to play it.
Hey, what it is, Stretch.
Music.
Hey, what it is, Stretch.
Music is my life.
Oh, God. Oh, every time what is his name? Helmethead? What the fuck?
Fuck, I forget Bill Mosey's name. Fuck it, in that movie.
God damn it.
They called him Chop Top. Duh.
Hello. Chop Top. There you go.
Yeah. Chop Top Sawyer.
That's what my Pringles can calls me.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Don't open it! It's not Pringles!
It smells like bleach!
Once you pop, you can't stop.
Oh my god. But yeah, I mean, dude, I don't want to talk too much about Texas Chainsaw 2 because I cannot wait to... We've already got a busy season coming up. We're all the way booked through...
December.
What? November, December.
Yeah, we're pushing it
with franchises and shit. So, yeah, I don't want to talk too much on it, but the Chainsaw series is definitely coming.
Yeah, it's due its justice. All right, so we fast forward 93. He did Body Bags. He co-directed that with Carpenter. He did Robert Englund. He returned to Stephen King. And he did The Mangler. Which The Mangler for me was like when Stephen King's work was being attacked and they did like Graveyard Shift with
that was piss poor.
Well that's what it is. Like everybody was going after a Stephen King property, like what can we get? All right, we'll do Graveyard Shift with fucking what's his name from Child's Play, you know? All right, we'll do The Mangler, we'll get Robert Englund to play this fucking, you know, guy that runs this laundry folding machine that gets possessed by a demon from hell, and you're like, what the fuck?
There's a little bit of me in that machine, and a little bit of it in me.
There was an accident today. The worst one I've ever seen.
Have you considered the possibility that the machine might be haunted?
That machine killed your daughter.
We all have to make sacrifices.
Human sacrifices.
A demon is a kind of electricity. Sometimes it gets out of control. People get hurt.
Three modern masters of horror have just created the ultimate machine for terror. Mangler.
It's like the best thing about The Mangler is seeing Ted Levine play this almost H.P. Lovecraft kind of detective. And that was like the best part. It was just seeing Ted Levine, who plays Ted Levine, you may all remember from, he plays he plays Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. So Ted Levine's just like, he's just like, I'm wondering where the fuck is a goddamn laundry machine that's possessed by a demon? You know, it's like, it's fun. And Robert Englund's like this weird, like, atrophied, fucking broken little prosthesis guy that runs this, laundry shop like a fucking, you know, dictator from, like, Nazi era and shit. So it's like, it's crazy, but it's fun. And it's filmed well, and that last 15 minutes is just weird as shit. But when you see Hooper's name to it, you're like, thank you, because that's the weirdness that we love to have invited in our horror genre, just like we do, you know, appreciate Graveyard Shift for all its weird, quirky, giant bat slime sweat fucking sequences and stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, Graveyard Shift was fun.
But yeah, I mean,
well, now we know why Blue Ribbon moved into making Pabst Blue Ribbon and ice cream.
There you go.
Their laundry service was no good.
Yeah. We'll just go with that guy. But as Hooper, you know, twinkled out, you know, he did some films like Mortuary. He did some Masters of Horror series for Showtime. He did the Dance of the Dead. And then for season two, he did the Damn Thing, which were both fun. I mean, I love seeing that some of the horror great directors got to come in and chime in on some of these fucking, you know, unique little short stories like Tales from the Crypt kind of shit.
Yeah, Freddy's Nightmares. You know, did No More Mr. Nice Guy, which is actually one of the best episodes.
Totally.
Did anybody watch that show? I didn't.
I totally. Nope. Oh, dude, that and like Perversions of Science, which was kind of like a science fiction Tales from the Crypt that was like short lived. It was weird getting these kind of weird things. Like, it's like when they tried to reboot The Outer Limits. And that's what Hooper kind of went to. He went to like TV land for God knows how many fucking years doing little episodes here and there of things. But his voice early, like we always talk about Carpenter, you know, Carpenter was really strong for a certain amount of years. Well, Hooper was the same way. He had these years where he just proved his true worth and significance in the horror genre and many genres he crossed, you know, into, but he always had that element of creating things that were truly fun, unique, and original.
Yeah, it really was from 1974 to about 1993, 95-ish, you know, that's when he kind of started falling off and doing a lot less projects and, you know, whatnot. But, I mean, during that time frame, you got, you know, the Funhouse, you got Poltergeist, you got Texas Chainsaw, you got Chainsaw 2, Night Terrors, Body Bags, I mean, he had a really good start in his career. And then, like, towards about right after, like, The Mangler, he only made, like, five more movies.
Yeah. I mean,
that's all the way to 2013. So he just, you know, he's selective. But he didn't come from the same apartment complex as Heather Langenkamp. I mean, he was wealthy. he didn't need to work.
Yeah.
So, you know, it worked.
And that's, it's a sad fucking story, but it's becoming very, I mean, we talk about, like, artists like Picasso and, you know, Van Gogh and stuff like that. And it's like, you see that these guys create masterpieces, but, you know, they never get the recognition. They were never valued truly at, you know, while they were alive. But once they're gone, you realize what they left behind were, like, pretty much the foundation for what Eli Roth and James Wan and, you know, everybody who has, like, James Gunn, all these great directors stood on the shoulders of these great fucking godfathers of horror to become and elevate the genre to what hopefully goes in a solid, steady, good direction. Because, I mean, if anything, Blumhouse has proven to be a fucking, you know, a cornerstone for creating and giving the right tools for people to, you know, to build off of these godfathers.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot of people, they don't, you know, they know Carpenter, but they don't bow their heads to guys like Hitchcock and Hooper and guys that came before Carpenter. I mean, even Carpenter said Texas Chainsaw changed his fucking life.
Yeah.
Just like, that movie blew my hair back.
Yeah.
So then 4 years later, he did Halloween and blew everybody else's hair back. So, I mean, there's always a stepping point. And wherever it started in the 50s with, well, not Ed Wood, but, I mean, Ed Wood tried to do it. But, like, the early 50s directors and 40s and 30s, the Frankensteins and the Draculas and Invisible Mans, these are all stepping stones to where we're currently at.
Yeah.
A lot of people forget that.
And that's what we need. We need guys that, I mean, if you're a true horror fanatic, you need these little stepping blocks to appreciate and have a good, solid direction to grow from. Because if not, you're watching the wrong shit. You're watching Hostel going, ooh, how can I make the next Hostel? Ooh, how can I make the next Paranormal Activity? And then guess what? You're an Amazon Prime fucking one-star fucking filmmaker. You know, you haven't gone to the school. You haven't learned the basics to create, you know, true originality. And that's why it's sad that we do get remakes of The Fog and remakes of, you know, this and that. It's like, you know what? Let's try to make solely new horror properties that can stand on their own 2 feet and open our eyes to something that maybe we haven't imagined or seen before.
Yeah, I mean, look, the director for Hatchet just secretly did a film with nobody knowing called Victor Crowley. And he premiered it last week as a like almost like they were there for the Hatchet Marathon. And mm-hmm. he was like, oh, no, there's a new movie. Here you go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. And he was able to keep it completely under wraps. And I actually really like that guy's style. I'm not a huge fan of Hatchet, but I respect it. But that guy's like, just when directors see the history and the past and know what they're talking about and know the genre, they make for such good films.
Oh, totally.
And these guys that come out and do one spinoffs, like we just got over the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, great director for music videos comes in to do Nightmare on Elm Street and we're not revisiting it, but good God.
Exactly. Yeah. And with Adam Green, yeah, he's the one that does the Hatchet series. It's like, yeah, dude, he runs a popular podcast. He knows all these people that, you know, that you put your heart and soul and your time into it, and you are underappreciated sometimes. But then again, when you go to these horror cons, you realize that your worth is so beyond, you know, some of these things. Like, when you see people that are truly affected by, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Poltergeist and stuff like that, it's like, you know what? These are huge, 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 huge cornerstones for people's horror genres, you know? And it's sad, you know? It's sad that when you meet a person that's like, hey, have you ever seen Carpenter's The Thing? Like, Nate, Ralph, y'all run into this a bunch. You'll meet some people of the youth or people that just totally are oblivious to, like, some of the main classics that, like, you know, y'all always give you give me shit for, like, not appreciating, like, Frankenstein or old black and white, but it's because, you know, it wasn't
a... don't put me in that category.
No, I'm saying you... I wear that.
I give everybody shit for not liking the old black and white.
And I wear that hat proudly because it's like, you know what, I'm not able to connect to it.
Proudly.
Yeah, I do, because... I'm not able to connect to it, so I have to imagine that some of these youthful fucking characters, they're missing out on a whole fucking wealth of knowledge that they just kind of, like, you know, kind of sidestep and totally neglect, which
I've always been a guy that goes back to the beginning. The black and whites weren't even the first incarnations that I saw of those films. It was more Hammer horror.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, okay, fuck, like, where did these come from? And went back about 40 fucking years. And I, you know, I watched Nosferatu, and I figured, you know, if I'm going to watch and like something, let's see what the real spinoffs were from.
Gotcha.
And I appreciate him for that. Do I put on, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein all the time? No, but I'll watch them about once a year.
But
you show your appreciation to the classics because it paves the way to what we're at today.
Totally.
Exactly.
I mean,
I wouldn't have Michael Myers if it wasn't for fucking Invisible Man or Creature or any of those guys. Like, there wouldn't be a Jason Voorhees without Creature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, all this shit spawned from this love of horror.
And I think that's the reason I shy away from the black and white, because I see where Carpenter or Craven or somebody has elevated the faults that came before it, like Dracula and stuff like that. I know they're great.
100%.
They're great stories, but they've elevated it. Now it's hard to find a Jordan Peele. It's hard to find, you know, like a James Wan that have elevated Craven or Carpenter's unique fucking take on horror. And that's what I'm looking forward to now, is like seeing the next person that's like says, fuck, I love James Wan, but you know what? I'm going to do a Conjuring without the stupid CG bird shit. I'm going to elevate his fucking, you know, footstep, and then I'm going to take it to the next thing.
Yeah. I mean, you get directors like, say, Ty West. He does really good films, but they're all based in the model of the Carpenter early 80s era.
Gotcha.
Which is, like, sweet to me. I'm like, fuck yeah. But at the same time, for new age kids like this, it's like, oh, this is really slow paced. You know what I mean? Like,
he took what his knowledge was and just kept it at that and didn't try to evolve it like a Juan does or Jordan Peele or whoever these new directors are. You got to have an evolution or else it gets stale. Totally. And that's what happened in the late 80s, early 90s. Is horror movies were a fucking joke because nobody knew how to take what Carpenter and Craven and Hooper and all these other great directors, they weren't able to take that and push forward. Take these broken wings. The only guy that kind of changed the mold a little bit would be Clive Barker. But yeah. I mean, he kind of fizzled out, you know, pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, he was on a huge fucking thing, like, you know, Hellraiser, Nightbreed. He was doing Lords of Illusion. He was just on the peak of, like, creating things that were truly unique and original. And then, like you said, he just kind of fizzled out.
Well, I blame it because Pinhead became so popular.
Yeah.
You know, so he holds it. It's kind of weird, like how Carpenter does. They hold a disdain for the people, for the creatures that made them. You know,
yeah.
Barker's been on record saying fucking Hellraiser Pinhead has pretty much ruined, you know, my writing because everybody wants Pinhead. That's why this last book he wrote, he killed Pinhead off.
Yeah. Kind of like, we're done with this.
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah, I remember y'all saying that.
About the survivor.
Yeah, I remember y'all saying that whenever we did talk about Clive Barker briefly in one of our previous episodes, that he is upset because he didn't want it to be about survivors, but unfortunately Pinhead grew to such a big popularity, he had to bring him back for the next movies, and he just despised it because, like, this is not what this movie's about. It's not about watching Pinhead do all this, but
yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately that's what the audience liked about the movie.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's hard when you get entrapped, you know, you're painted into a corner. Because what are you going to do? Release Hellraiser 3 or 4 without Pinhead?
Oh, we just sat through it with the Krueger series. It's like, what, like when we talked about, I think the most excited I got, I think when we're talking about Krueger is like, what if we did use the guy that does like Mama or Record, you know, that big motherfucker. It's like, what if you did create Krueger to be like this nightmare demon that was shapeless, that could create.
That'd be badass.
Yeah, he could become the boogeyman in your fantasy nightmare or your down the dark alley nightmare. He was shapeless.
See, but that's kind of the difference between, you know, Freddy and his creator of Craven and Pinhead and his creator of Clive Barker.
Yeah.
Craven wrote this movie with Freddy Krueger in mind, villain, blah, and then the series took off.
Yeah.
Barker wrote it with Cenobites. You know, it wasn't Pinhead.
Yeah.
It was the mold, and
it was the idea of the box. It was the idea of the of what happens when you interpret hell and through this box.
Yeah. Stuff like that. And as he wanted it, he, you know, the man's a visionary fucking. I would love to see what makeup designs and shit he would have came up with, but he always was stuck in the corner of, I've got to bring Pinhead back.
Yeah.
He's got to be the leader, which he didn't want to do.
Oh, he got, yeah.
Yeah.
Pinhead and all the other Cenobites got slapped with a copyright, and that was it. Let's market this.
Yep.
And that's why
keep writing this.
And that's why I love the idea of, like, if you could truly just circle it down and knock it down with, like, maybe the Thorn conspiracy and stuff like that with Halloween. If you could solidify an idea of the shape, or like we talked about Halloween 3, if like one of the masks would have came off the production line that would create a boogeyman, it's like that would create this whole aspect of like possibilities, because you're having unique situations expand from like being exposed to the mask and creating more maniac shapes and boogeymen within a world that could be, you know, stories could be just, you know, it could be like endless, you know, the possibilities.
Yeah. Like, and each town has its own Thorn.
Yeah, exactly. Like, ooh, you know, like, yeah, when people get the pop vinyls and shit like that, and like, ooh, you get that one variant. Well, what if like just one town of every like little city or town or state got like a fucking Myers mask, and that created your boogeyman for that town, and every state or town had a story of like the kid or child or adult or person that was exposed to that mask and that madness.
That'd be like a good version of The Purge.
Yep, there you go. And I was like, oh,
I can see that.
You got a pumpkin, you got a witch, you got a skull, you just fucking melted. This motherfucker.
I would have loved to see them continue the anthology aspect of Halloween, but we'll get into that in October.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, looking back for Tobe, God, he's going to be missed. I know the dude didn't do a lot of work recently, but you know, when you lose people who help mold your childhood, it's never easy.
No.
No.
It was a shitty situation. You know, we've had Carpenter go. We had Gunnar Hansen go. We had the tall man go. No.
We didn't have Carpenter go.
Or no.
Craven. Romero.
Hansen, Romero.
Yeah, the other Steve.
Yeah, Craven.
Romero. Yeah. I mean, Gunnar Hansen, the tall man. I mean, these, our icons are dying off, man.
Yeah. It's sad to witness.
That's the sad part about these celebrities. Like, a lot of these big guys passing away. Because even though, yeah, you didn't know them personally, you might have met them in passing, whatever have you. Like, in a way, they were kind of your friend because they gave you something to enjoy. They gave you something to watch. And even though their legacy does carry on through those movies and whatnot, the thing that hurts the most is knowing that they're not going to be coming back to bring you something else.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's what hurts the most about these directors and whatnot. And even with Mr. Hooper, like, hell, like, yeah, he didn't really do a whole hell of a lot near the end of his life, but it would have been great to see him come back and make a resurgence of something, you know?
Yeah, can you imagine if he was directing this new Chainsaw movie that was coming out? Oh, my God, I'd be there fucking front row.
Yeah,
I mean, hopefully not front row, more middle row. I hate being in front row, but I'd be there. I mean, somebody needs to grab Carpenter and throw him in a cryogenic chamber quick.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad he's directing TV shows.
Walt Disney.
Oh, there you go.
The Walt Disney. Yeah, park him right there with Walt Disney and the real Stanley.
There you go.
Awesome. So, we give you a big salute there, Mr. Hooper. You will be missed. Rest in peace, sir, to all families and, you know, everybody else that's like a horror fanatic, you know.
We lost another big one.
Yep.
He would definitely be missed.
Recently on Netflix, Adam Wingard, he directed the new Death Note. And I caught it. And I'm not gonna lie, I wasn't a big fan of the anime. I watched maybe like the first three episodes of the 37 episodes that are from the original Death Note series, but I enjoyed the film. It was fun. I wouldn't say it's straight horror, but it does have its Final Destination elements to it. It was beautiful to catch. It was filmed great. It looked great. It felt like Final Destination budget, you know, it was really solid fucking, you know, you appreciate when these films come out and they're on Netflix and you just stream them for your little fucking, you know, monthly subscription. It was a solid flick. I mean, I was glad to watch it, you know. I couldn't.
Hey, what was the other one that came out on Netflix that was the Tucker and Dale director?
Oh, that comes out September 1st. That's Little Evil with Adam Scott and Evangeline Lilly. So we catch that.
Oh, Adam Scott's in it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, from the Krampus?
Yeah. I like that guy.
So it looks fun.
I'll have to watch that then.
It looks like a mixture of The Omen and, like, Problem Child.
Oh, no.
So it looks fun. It looks goofy, you know?
Sounds like something Atticus needs to watch.
Yeah.
Junior! God damn it.
And I know, speaking of John Ritter, what do you guys, I mean, here we are, we're on the cusp of like the new It coming out, you know, it's almost here, but to reflect a little with the John Ritter-ness, what do you guys fond memories of Stephen King's, I think it was Tommy Lee Wallace that directed the, the TV movie of It.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All in three.
Did you guys watch this miniseries when it came out on TV back in the Dizay?
Fucking A!
I'm not gonna lie, I did not. I had to wait till it came out on fucking DVD years ago.
Gotcha.
That's what made me afraid of clowns.
I watched.
And then I realized later in life that clowns are just like weird cokeheads. Like, okay.
They're not all.
I still don't like them.
And they drink Faygo.
Yeah. Oh, not oh, those God. Clowns. I'm talking like Steve-O, Barnum and Bailey clowns.
Oh, gotcha.
God, I mean, they're just like, all right, snort a line. Let's go deal with these fucking kids. Hey, kid, fuck you.
That's fucking hilarious. What I remember, though, is when I was a kid, you would get something there called, it's something I don't know any current fucking existing teenager or child like actually realizes that we used to have to buy a TV guide when you went to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And within the TV guide, you would get basic instructions like, ooh, David Copperfield has a new magic show coming out, you know, on the weekend. Or Tommyknockers, Stephen King's Tommyknockers, or Stephen King's...
The Stand.
The Stand.
Needful Things.
Exactly. Like, Stephen King would have these TV miniseries that would come out on TV, and that was like your bridge to know what the fuck is coming. And when I saw Stephen King and you see that TV ad of that fucking clown, you're like, holy shit, this is going to be unique.
Yeah, it's funny, man. I actually read the book before the miniseries came out. I was like fucking 9 or 10. But Stephen King's not like a perplexing writer. You know, he uses four-letter basic words. I get it. I was able to follow it. But, I mean, that was like a 900-some-odd page book, dude. And for a 10-year-old to be intrigued, I never knew it was going to be a clown. You know, they describe it in a book, but, you know, like, I wasn't afraid of clowns at that time. So I was like, oh, okay, some fucking clown is like a weird fucking shape-shifting fucking thing. When I saw the miniseries, that scared the fuck out of me. The book didn't really frighten me. But, man, the miniseries. Tim Curry's goddamn fucking portrayal of Pennywise was just like, it's funny now as an adult, but as a kid, that was fucking mortifying.
Yeah.
You know, when he comes out of the shower drain and shit. Fuck you. I never showered in school. I was always like, no, I'll just go the rest of the day, sweaty ass and all. Like,
school regulations, kid. Go take a shower.
Well, I ain't even fucking with that or my fifi. Like, I'm going straight to class.
No masturbation for you.
Oh. Well, I'd go to the nurse's office for that.
Yeah, rub one out with the ice pack.
They have the cleanest bathrooms in the nurse's office.
There you go. It's fresh soap.
And the nicer beds.
The napkin dispenser is full.
That's right. And nobody in sight. Ain't nobody trying to kick it when you say, oh, I have a fever, I don't feel good.
What I loved about this is that it was like a chance to come in during your Thursday or Friday or whatever night. It was usually like a Sunday or something like that. Like, you would just come in. And at 7 p.m. for 2 fucking hours, you would get this mini-series. And with the intro of this, you have the little girl on the tricycle. The mom saying, oh, a storm's coming, honey. I'm pulling in the laundry. Come on in. And the little girl goes into her yard. And there's like a simple clothesline. You know, there's sheets hanging from it. And the little girl sees a little glimpse. And it's like, what the fuck is that? She's smiling at it. And then the clown just growls and gives her that grin that could just creep.
That grin.
Yeah. And after that, you're just in. You're in for this ride that's going back and forth between the youth of this small losers club. And you know, it drifts back and forth between, you know, the kids and the adults. And getting that experience in a TV miniseries, it was awesome.
And it was different. You know, you did the kids, you know, at first, and then you did the adult segment, the second 2-hour fucking, you know,
tune in next week. What happened? Leave you on hanging street. But I always enjoyed the kids segments a lot more than I liked the adult ones.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you got Jonathan Brandis, Seth Green. Fuck, I don't even know all of them anymore. But
The main kid was like, what, Brandon Fraser or something like that? Or
Brandon? No, Jonathan Brandis.
There you go, Jonathan Brandis.
From Sidekicks, homie.
Yeah. He was awesome. I mean, he really knocked it out of the park. Because, I mean, that whole introduction story of him and his brother, Georgie, and the way he's taken by it. Was just, it's just iconic. It's like solidified in like so many horror fanatics, horror fans, like brains. It's like, you know, it's like watching a kid order ice cream at a fucking, you know, from an ice cream truck. It's like that little moment when you see a kid in a yellow fucking, you know, raincoat or any kind of like paper fucking boat or storm drain, you're just solidified with that memory of the clown being down there.
Hi, Georgie. Aren't you gonna say hello? Oh, come on, bucko. Don't you want a balloon?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers. My dad said so.
Very wise of your dad, Georgie. Very wise indeed. I, Georgie, am Pennywise, the dancing clown. You are Georgie. So now we know each other. Correct?
I guess so. I gotta go.
Go? Without this?
My boat!
Exactly. Go on, kiddo. Take it. Oh. You want it, don't you, Georgie? Oh, of course you do. And there's cotton candy and rides and all sorts of surprises down here. And balloons, too. All colors.
Do they float?
Oh, yes. They float, Georgie. They float. And when you're down here with me, you float!
Fuck.
No thanks, dude. Yeah, I mean the storm drain scene as a kid, I was just like, oh, that's fucking, that's unsettling. Why is there a clown in this storm drain? And then he, you know, shows his teeth, his eyes go yellow. It was just like, what?
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm really looking forward to this remake to see what they change.
Yeah, totally.
I'm really, I cannot wait to see certain scenes because they look, you know, they look updated. They look creepier to me.
Yeah, no, they really do. Like the movie looks, the new one looks fucking amazing. It looks to me a lot fucking scarier. And with the kid that's playing Pennywise now, they released an extended scene, I think earlier today, of the storm drain scene. Oh, they released an actual clip of it, of Georgie actually getting to the storm drain, yelling "No!" you know, trying to get to the boat, and the reveal of Pennywise, and just that little, like, I think 30-second, 45-second clip, however long it was. Man,
man, indeed.
The kid that's playing Pennywise sells it, and he sells it damn good.
Yeah, I mean, when they released him speaking to him, which was, I think, just a couple of weeks ago, where he's like, come on, take it. It's like, fuck.
Take it. Fuck. Take it. Take it.
Oh, man. Like, I can't wait. But anyways, let's go back to the original. Sorry. Off track.
No, you're good.
No, I think the original stands on its own. I mean, for it coming out in, like, the 1990, like, you know, 1990, here we are. And you're exposed to it as a fucking made-for-TV movie. I mean, it's almost like we were just talking about Little Evil and Death Note. It's like these things were made and they were just given to you for fucking free. You know, your pay for admission was literally a fucking commercial.
Yeah. Dude, like, miniseries are always crazy. I want to say these got released on a Wednesday.
Yeah, because they would play, like, during the week. Yeah, you're right.
It was like USA Network.
No, it was like, yeah. Well, it was like USA Network, but it was like CBS or something like that. They would run from like 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And literally, yeah, like, your admission was watching those fucking commercials, because you're like getting all these little 15-minute pieces and then a commercial, 15-minute piece and then a commercial. So you literally sat there for 2 hours to get like an hour and a half movie, you know?
Yeah.
But man, I mean, like, the stories, like, when Mike would call all of the kids as adults and he would tell them, hey, I need you to come back to Derry. And then the kid would be like, or the adult would go ahead to, like, drift back, because they've been torn away from Derry for so long that they've kind of like fogged out and forgotten, you know, what had happened in their past. And I love that the thing's like a Jeepers Creepers kind of creature. It comes back every 27 years to, like, just wreak havoc. I love that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was on ABC, and it was three succession nights. It was November 18th, 19th, and the 20th.
Wow.
But 30 million viewers.
Jesus fuck.
I bet old fucking Stephen King and Tommy Lee Wallace are kicking themselves in the ass for not releasing 30 million just in viewers. I mean, imagine the ticket sales, the box office it would have done.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's cool. ABC did it, and fucking, you know, it was like, it won I think 2 or 3 Emmys.
Gotcha. So, and it's like you said, everybody praised it for like that first good half, because you have all the kids' story. You know, you have all the kids, the Losers Club coming together and fighting the clown. But like that, the weaker second story was the adults. It was the sadness of, like, you know, of the reluctancy of like these adults, these males, and fucking Viv and all these characters coming back together to try to, like, you know, reluctantly, like, yeah, fight off evil. And it's like, do you not realize that this thing's literally coming back for like almost a whole year and just killing children and random people, you know, that it just chooses to come back and just feed upon the town? And that's what was so unique. It's like, I had watched the TV movie and just lived with it for so many years. And then when I finally invested my time into reading the fucking novel, it's like, I don't know how to explain it to people. It's like, when you read Stephen King's The Stand or Dark Tower, you enter this fantasy world that Stephen King rarely, like, deals with within his horror novels. But it is kind of a marriage between both. You have this great horror novel, but within the middle of it, you're thrusted into this fantasy land. Because the things that they couldn't shoot in the TV movie are like the way that Bill, who's played by Jonathan Brandis, the way that Bill, like, attacks, yeah, it in the book. He goes to, like, he learns this ritual of Chud, and he visits this flying turtle that Earth and the galaxy lives on the back of, and all humanity is created within the mind of this floating turtle.
And yeah, we live on the back of it.
And it's like, you're introduced all this weird shit in the book that is never could possibly be explained in TV form, let alone, I don't think they're going to delve into it in the film at all. If they do, it's going to be like the mind fuck of the century for, like,
film. I don't think they will.
Yeah, because I don't think it works. It works great on paper because it works into the Dark Tower series and stuff like that, how he's one of the keepers of the beams that keeps the Dark Tower afloat and stuff like that. It works within that realm, and it works within the creature of Robert Gray, who's also known as Pennywise. In the book, it works as a solid piece of work. Like, when you read the Georgie fucking sequence and stuff like that, it's, like, haunting. But when you see it in the TV movie, it takes more of a practical horror filmatic, you know, like, film fucking way of accepting, you know, like, a scary story. But when you read in the book, it's like, wow, the, you know, like, Bill's friend, fucking, not Mike, I forget his name, but he's affected by the fucking bullies a certain way, and this happens, and that happens, and everything has a purpose. And then you have Maturin, and then you have the Battle of the Wheels and all this stuff like that. And they have all this weird uniqueness and viewpoints. But yeah, when you watch the film, it's like totally different from like the experience you have when you read the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the book never scared me, talking about Bob the Turtle or whatever. It was just like, what the fuck is this shit?
I was like, we get our... It was like magic. It was like Magic the Gathering, you know, within the horror genre. It's like, oh, we get our power from Gon or Gan or whatever the fuck it was. It was like, what the fuck is going on? And it's like, oh, but this is cool because you're reading it.
Yeah.
And then when there's a certain point in the book where it takes like the whole premise of like you're in the POV of Pennywise, and Pennywise talks to you. It's like he's a creature that has existed for millions of years before time has even existed and stuff like that. And he speaks to like the children as like terrifying him, is like salting the meat before he eats, you know. It's like he loves eating children because it's like a delicacy. So it's unique, you know. And that's why it's fun when like they realize that he has to take physical form in order to affect the children as he feeds and stuff, a la like Jeepers Creepers and kind of shit like that. It's neat. But like, as far as the TV movie, like we're talking to it being like this free, you know, gift that ABC or TBS gave us. All you had to do was sit through the fucking commercials. It was like, wow, you know, that was cool for the time, especially in the 1990s, you know?
Yeah, I think it's funny that they modeled Pennywise after Bozo, Clarabelle, and Ronald McDonald.
Exactly. It's like, we'll go in this direction.
Dude, it's different, man. I mean, God, I can't remember too many ministries other than Salem's Lot that were this huge and this highly watched, highly regarded thing.
Yeah.
You know, it blew up. So...
And that's what I'm looking forward to, but I'm also scared that the remake or the new version of it, I mean, hopefully it follows suit, but hopefully it's not like, it's like we just spoke to, like the novel is what it is, and it has this unique take. Obviously, the Dark Tower was a great thing, but obviously it didn't hit the marks that I guess maybe some of the studios were hoping it would, but... I don't think it's going to touch base on some of the stuff that the novel touched on. They're going to stick more to the horror dynamics and elements, because in the novel, like, it becomes Frankenstein's monster. It becomes a werewolf. It plays so many variants of like to strike fear in these kids. It was really fun to read. But in the movie, it's kind of touched upon, you know, the leper. You know, you don't get the story of the two drowned boys and stuff like that that affects Stan later on in different chapters of the book. But as far as... Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, I was just saying. But that's what I'm curious to see, if, like, we're going to have a strong It remake part one, but maybe part two might not be as strong because now you're having to deal with the after effects of, like, the 30 years or 20... I'm sorry, 27 years passing, and you're kind of losing all that... affection you had for the first part because you're having to move over so fast to maybe the adult side of the story for part two.
Yeah.
And I really hope that they don't do that, because I don't know. I feel as though that would take away from the film itself, because you're so focused on one part of the story and then you have to focus on the second part and you have to try and remember everything and yada, yada, yada. It kind of turns into that entire ordeal with like the Attack on Titan movie.
Yeah.
Remember they've splitting that up into two parts, and the second movie, like half of it was taken up by trying to remind you of all the shit that happened in the previous fucking movie.
And I hate that, you know? It's like you're paying admission to get 20 minutes of what you just paid admission for last year.
Yeah. I honestly doubt they'll do that. I mean, I think, you know, this director coming into this, he's the dude from Mama.
Yeah, he's the dude that did Mama.
I think he'll tell a cohesive tale. I just always find kids dealing with horror a lot more terrifying than adults dealing with horror.
And what I'm glad they're doing, though, is that they've expanded it. Like, with the guy who did True Detective, Cary Fukunaga, whatever the fuck his name is, he wanted to, like, I don't want to go to the fucking 50s to tell you the kid's story. Let's modernize it. So they're making the kid's story more relevant, so they're within the 80s realm. So when you do come back for part two, they're more in current, like, now time, you know, obviously. Like, nice. 20, and I thought that was genius because I was like, cool. But now I'm thinking, like, what is the it's – like, you now you're saying, okay, we're going to do it in the 80s, but we're still going to use, like, an 1800s-type clown. Is he still going to have change abilities that are more 80s prominent, or is he going to still reach to, like, the werewolf and stuff like that that the kids were dealing with in the 50s in the novelization – the novel version, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I doubt he'll turn into, like, David Hasselhoff.
Yeah, or is he going to turn into, like, fucking, like, a Carpenter thing or, you know, like, we're, fucking Michael Jackson's Thriller, you know?
Yeah, we're Knight Riders, so actually turns into the car.
Oh!
But I'm interested to see how he pulls it, man, and I'm interested to see what they do with the duology, you know? The, you know, part one, we obviously have glimpses of that look terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, we have no idea who the hell is even casted for the second one.
Yeah. Exactly. They haven't talked about that at all. Actually, the fucking director's talked about remaking Nightmare on Elm Street more than he's talked about getting prepped for part two.
Well, maybe he's not going to do part two.
God, I hope he
does. Maybe they're tapping him to retell the first story, get it big, and then buy a cheaper director to do the second one. That's always a worrisome. Yeah.
Then they
bot.
Get like fucking Resident Evil's Paul Anderson or something like that to do fucking Paul W. S. Anderson. We'll get Uwe Boll to fucking do part two of it.
Oh, no.
But Uwe Boll's he's too butthurt about people not liking his movies to care.
No, they'll probably fucking throw what's his goddamn head, the dude from that's screwing up all the Batman and DC shit.
Oh, God. They'll get Zack Snyder.
Snyder.
Look at Snyder.
Oh, God damn it. I was going to talk about Schumacher.
Schumacher? Oh God. We will get the turtle story then.
We'll get Pennywise with a nipple suit.
Yeah, I was about to say. Yeah. We'll show the clown nipples.
Technically, what we are is we are sperm on the back of a giant turtle. What?
Oh, God damn it.
Wow. That's like the introduction for part two. You're like literally like a 3D voyage on the turtle.
Yeah, like another turtle.
No, not a turtle. It's like a Pringles can.
No, you'll get the death of the turtle. You see it actually like eat a galaxy. You're like, oh, he's choking on a galaxy. Oh my gosh.
It's like two turtles fucking. Splooge is on its back and then zooms into the splooge, and that's our universe.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy Serkis.
Yes, Andy Serkis.
We'll do the mocap for the turtle. Oh my gosh,
that sounds horrible. You know, I'd actually welcome seeing if this guy did something like Mama, you know, doing Nightmare, but you know, I don't want to revisit Freddy.
Yeah, I'm a little Freddy. I'm not ready to go there anymore.
Not ready for Freddy? Come on.
No.
One more movie.
Maybe if I got a fucking paycheck, maybe you'll get me to invest my time in it. But no, I don't think I'll ever do that freely again.
Mm-hmm.
It's I'm going to need like fucking like some Patreon fucking money to ever go back to Freddy Land. I'd be like, shit.
I'd rather watch fucking Chuck Norris's Firewalker.
Yeah.
Who?
I'd gladly watch
Lou Gossett Jr.
Oh yeah, I'd rather watch Louis Gossett Jr.'s fucking filmography than ever having to revisit the fucking Nightmare on Elm Street series again.
What? Yeah, like Digstown.
Oh yeah, I'd love to watch Digstown. I watched that on loop for a year.
That's only because James Woods is in it.
Oh yeah, James Woods is awesome. I love James.
Love James Wood.
I would have loved to seen James Wood as Pennywise.
Oh man, get the fuck over here, kid! Come on.
I love little kids.
piece of kid soul. Piece of kid soul.
Yeah, I mean,
piece of children.
Oh God,
I don't know how to make.
Yeah, I mean, the original. If you guys haven't seen it, you should check it out, but understand there's going to be out of almost a 4-hour movie.
It's like 3 hours, 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. So understand out of that 3 hours, you're probably only getting 1 hour of good shit.
Yeah.
The rest is a lot of, you know, I hate the old stuff. I hate all the
You know, I'm pretty sure you can find a cut of, like, just the kids.
Yeah, I mean, I love John Ritter, and I really like what he did, but I couldn't stand the guy that played Bill. I couldn't stand, I couldn't stand any of them.
He beats his fist against the post and still he sees the fucking ghost. I was like, God damn it. Today, Junior?
Why is your stutter back? Oh, no. Like, the adults is what I'm worried about for part two.
Yeah. Hopefully they just get Tom Hardy to beat all of them.
It's like in Legend. One of them's wearing glasses. One of them has comb back hair.
Yeah, it was a stutter back. I did it when I had no friends.
God damn it. Fucking beep, beep, Richie.
Beep, beep, Richie. Mike Hamlin, good to see you, sir.
I mean, you got to understand, viewers.
Excuse me, madam.
When you're watching it, you are going to have a lot of boring time. Pretty much any time the kids are on screen or Tim Curry's on screen, it's magic.
It's magic.
Yeah. But the older segments I never really liked. I didn't care about.
Yeah, John Ritter and
I wonder if they're going to introduce the gangbang.
The gangbang?
Yeah, in the book.
Oh, got you.
Beverly, yeah. They all have sex with down at the creek.
God damn it! There was a lot of weird shit. Because even like the little sissy boy guy, he gets his arm broke like twice or some shit by the. I mean, it's a lot of shit that happens. I mean, even all the crap. I mean, that's the thing with the bully gang, Belch and Bowser, or where the fuck their names are. I mean, they
Bowers.
Bowers. Thank you. Henry Bowers. Yeah, like all their characters play like this weird piece because it's like it can influence them to kind of do physical harm to these things because the kids are kind of empowered by their spiritual connection, all this other shit that plays into it in the book. But when you watch in the movie, it's like, you know, it's just a click that clicks and they're able to stand against, you know, the bullies, but they don't really speak to what uniqueness that they have, that they're able to stand to this immortal fucking, you know, creature.
Yeah. Other than a gangbang bond.
Yeah, the gangbang bond needs to be further explained, you know.
The D-double-D.
D-double-D in the house, Steve-O!
No, seriously.
I'm not going to lie. I really don't want to. I haven't read the book, and I'm a little concerned about this gangbang bond.
Skip to page 311.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the book that's just like...
Well, like, my concern is this during the kid time or the adult time?
Yeah, no, it's the kid time.
Oh, it's weird. What I remember loosely, because I've been rereading it, but then I haven't gotten to the last couple of chapters, but there's a sequence that I remember in my mind going like, okay, like, when it takes physical form as a spider, there's a thing that Bill does... And he actually enters the inside of the spider. Like, he's actually goes inside of it somehow. I know in the TV movie, they ripped the heart out. But in the book, it's like Bill and Richie are like the ones that fight the hardest in the book. And they go inside of like the clown or like the physical form of the spider, the giant spider, to tear it apart or whatever, the fucking kill it. And it's weird, man, because it's like the second they kill the spider or they kill the physical representation of the creature, it's like after they leave the cave or the sewers, they just like the fog, just like everything about it that's had any effect on them, just kind of like it just leaves them. So any memory of that summer of them becoming the click, all this shit just like it just evaporates all memory. Even the shit that Mike Hanlon has been writing his journals and stuff, like, that disappears too. So it's like any memory of this situation just kind of like just goes, you know. It's kind
of. Well,
like,
I mean, I guess that's a plus for Beverly.
Yeah, total plus.
No longer the town whore.
Yeah, because I think Liv and fucking Haystack, they end up going together and they end up like happy ever after, you know. My heart burns there too and shit. And then
it was the heart.
Yeah, no shit. It's that groin area that kind of gets a little fiery. You know,
need to go get a shot.
You know, Bowers didn't know where to put it.
Oh,
all right. But yeah, the whole Bill thing and Audra's fucking catatonic shit. I mean, all these unique things are in the book, and they're spoke to in the film. But like I said, it's very Shawshank. It's very rushed in the TV movie, but what do you expect? I mean, whenever you do a book to TV form, you get, you know, The Stand.
Oh, God.
I don't want to talk about The Stand.
No. But, I don't want to talk about anything else.
And that's the problem with Stephen King. I mean, you have such a unique grasp and love for what you're having to be forced, you know, to read sometimes or enjoyed. You know, it depends. It's a fine line between in Stephen King enjoyment and reading. But yeah, dude, I mean, for the TV movie, it aimed where it did. Tim Curry knocked it out of the fucking park of creating a Pennywise that would be feared and loved and just fucking adored for, you know, end of days.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
He's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm wondering, you know, Stephen King, you know, is previous movies, I don't think directors got what Stephen King was doing. Stephen King was world building.
Yeah.
Everything is centered around Derry and Maine and all these little towns. I wonder if this is going to be like the start, you know, like how they're revamping the Universal monsters.
Yeah. With the,
I wonder if this is going to be the start of, you know, because it's such a huge, I mean, one of his best books. I wonder if this is going to be the start of a world-building process of new Stephen King movies, because it, in the book, mentions people from The Shining and The Dead Zone.
And Shawshank. The they talk about Shawshank.
And Dreamcatchers and Tommyknockers, The Stand, Children of the Corn. All these are mentioned in the
book. Yeah.
So I wonder if they're going to elaborate and do a world-building in Stephen King's universe.
The
SKU.
And that's what's weird, because I mean, with the Dark Tower being what it is, and they're talking about a Dark Tower's TV series. Obviously, I'm getting drunker as this episode goes on, folks.
Go Jeff.
And then you know, you have Castle Rock coming to Hulu. I mean, yeah, I mean, to start putting these things together.
Just did The Mist.
Exactly, you know, the mystery TV series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, if they start connecting the dots and start putting this shit together, it would be neat, I guess. But then it's kind of like, also, you're looking over your shoulder like, yeah, I never expect Netflix's Defenders to ever touch upon what MCU solidified, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't think it's just a money issue, but I think it's just like the way things are I guess, kind of built, you know what I mean?
Like, well, I mean, the way they'd have to do it is going to have to hit a home fucking run.
Yeah.
Which I think it will. But
Dark Tower didn't hit a home fucking run. That's the fucking scary thing.
The Dark Tower's not really that great.
But the Dark Tower would solidify the creatures of Maturin and all these fucking things that were solidified for, like when people question, like, the energy or the things that create The Shining and stuff like that, it's like, all these things are solidified within the Dark Tower. If you read, like, certain chapters within, like, even Dreamcatcher, like you said, it's like when Dr. Gray wants to introduce the worms into the sewer line and stuff like that, and they find the Monument of the Children, and inscribed or graffitied on the monument is Pennywise Lives. It's like there's a macroverse that everything's solidified and created to because of King, but I don't think filmmakers or anybody knows how to attack that. We don't have a Kevin Feige, you know. Figgy, where the fuck?
No, what you'd have to do is just literal mentions.
Yeah,
you know, like in It Too, you know, the adult version, they're gonna have to bring up Dick Halloran.
Yeah,
maybe have Christine drive one of them to the town hall, because, you know, Christine the car was actually in the book as well. You know, and then when you make The Shining, Dick Halloran's gonna have to mention, oh, my friends in Derry, or, you know, there's a way to conjoin them all without actually being so bland as they're coming all together.
And I think you can
mentions.
I think you can have fun
with that. Maybe like a little
I was going to say, you probably have the Easter eggs in the films, but I think you could maybe represent it more in maybe the Castle Rock TV series, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Mm. I was going to say, like, they could probably pull, like, what they did with, what they do with, like, the Defenders or, like, any of the Netflix Marvel series where they'll mention it in passing, but it's a very nonchalant conversation.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or people who read the books go, ah, fuck. You know, and that's how you keep your fans.
Yeah.
And that's how you bring in new fans. I mean, I don't know if there's any plan to redo Shining.
They better not.
They better not. Yeah. I mean, they've already done it twice on TV miniseries.
Yeah, but the TV...
And both of them suck.
I think the TV series stood closer to the book, but the Shining Kubrick is like more of like an awesome artist representation of like what, you know...
Ingenious.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shining's a whole different... I mean, look, fucking 40 years later, we're still discussing what things meant in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fucking Rubik's Cube of a movie.
Oh, it's like watching De Palma's fucking Carrie. You know, it's like, yeah, I read the book because I love King's fucking unique take on that story, but I watched De Palma for a stylish fucking adaptation of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, hey, fuck, dude. I mean,
yeah. I mean, you always go back to the Chloe Moretz one. Definitely. Yeah.
Like, I'll read Pet Sematary to be fucking truly frightened, but I'll watch Pet Sematary to be like have a good fucking scare. Especially,
actually, they are talking about doing Pet Sematary.
I know, and I'm kind of wary of that.
Really?
I like the novel. I love the novel. I don't know how you can make the novel better. And that's the problem with the novel. It's like the novel's such a great thing. Even if you did the novel verbatim, I think you're still you're not elevating it. You know, you're not bringing it to somewhere that the novel isn't at. And I think Pet Sematary is a great it's great adaptation of it. I think the film is great, but I think the novel's better. But you know,
of course.
But I could never. I mean,
most of the time, the books are better.
Yeah, but I could never imagine a remake, you know, outdoing either. That's the sad fucking realism of Pet Sematary. I think what fucking, I forget her name, but I think what she set out and did, she knocked out of the fucking park. Like, I forget the chick that did Pet Sematary. Let me think. Her name is Mary Lambert. I think she directed a great adaptation. I mean, I think that and having Fred Gwynn, who fucking came out in The Monsters and stuff, it was just a perfect cast. It was the perfect, everything came together. The ingredients were perfect. And I think Pet Sematary is just like one of those movies that's just like, it's a damn near solid 8 in my, you know, in my horror universe ratings.
Yeah, that is a fucking great film. But I always think, man, you know, if it actually does it well, I think then that opens up the doors for all those.
They're going to start.
Because you can always do an update. You know what I mean?
And that's the problem. You
don't have to go shot for shot, but you can fucking, you know, update to the new generation and make a shit ton of money and probably get some goddamn good scares. Pet Sematary is pretty freaky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really fucking is.
But when you had King do King, you got Maximum Overdrive.
So oh, like, God, no. No,
so it's like you need to have a unique take to elevate his work. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's got to be.
Well, that's the thing is Stephen King's not really attached to this It project coming out.
No,
it's not Stephen King's It. It's just It.
But he wasn't on Dark Tower either. And you don't see fucking like rotten dick face vegetables fucking like saying, oh, it's the greatest film ever. But you also don't hear him saying it's fucking Suicide Squad, you know? It's like Rotten Tomatoes, there it is. You don't see them, you know, raving about it, but you don't see them, you know, talking shit about it either. It's like Dark Tower came out, it did what it did. It's still in the Stephen King verse, but everybody's just hyped up because It has always been It, you know? It's like, it's hard to do that wrong, but I guess we'll see because... This cocksucker's getting away with a lot because he's just sticking to the fun part. He's sticking to the youth. He's sticking to the losers club. If he starts venturing, once he starts spreading his wings out and he has to cover both sides of the fucking story, that's when you see if he goes limp or he's able to hold, you know, the weaker part of the story, you know, to where it needed to be. And that's why I talk about the book in length, because it's like there's a lot of shit that makes sense in the book because you're dealing with the fucking novel that I don't know how you translate it within, you know, in film world, you know. That's why I didn't. Yeah. That's why I didn't run to go see fucking Dark Tower. It's like, you know what? I'm gonna let that letdown come down to me when it's like on fucking 4K UHD. I'll go buy it for $20 and just be, you know, dissatisfied at home. I'm not gonna go out and buy you know, $40 worth of popcorn and shit and sit down and be like, meh, it's not as good as I thought. You know, I was like, shit.
Right. And you shouldn't have to be like, you shouldn't have to go waste money and time on something that you already know that. Not that big of a following. Like, yeah, there's a lot of people that are excited that this movie is coming out, but I don't want to do so much, you know.
All right, so we talked about the passing of Tobe Hooper. We talked about current releases like Death Note on Netflix. I know the new Annabelle came out, directed by the guy who did Mr. Sandberg, or whatever the fuck his name is, who did Lights Out. The new Annabelle is beyond. Like, I mean, what the first Annabelle was, the second Annabelle just, like, it beats it, like, four times the scare.
Oh, really? It's actually good, huh?
Yeah, like, it was like watching the first Ouija movie, and then you watch the second Ouija movie, and you're like, wow, the second Ouija movie's, like, amazing. The Origin of Evil, that's amazing. It was a really good scary film. But when I watched the new Annabelle Creation, that was like, wow, that was like the best $4.75 I ever spent, you know, because it was like good. It was really, 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 really well done. And it circles back to all kinds of things. It circles back to the original Annabelle, the first one. It circles back to an origin of the Nun. So it gets you ready for the Nun fucking standoff film. I mean, it was able to land so much groundwork within the Conjuring universe that I would dare call that one of my favorite horror films for this year so far.
So where would you guys rate this old It, or final thoughts, I guess, to wrap this up? Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, dude.
Like in the echelon of movies I've watched, or?
Yeah, just your final thoughts, and whether you buy, recommend, or however you want to do it.
Well, with the original It, like I said, I didn't get to see it till like fucking the till I got to watch it on like DVD. Like, I don't know. I don't even fucking remember when I got to watch it. I just remember getting it on DVD, and then I just recently actually rebought it for Blu-ray because I wanted to rewatch it before we ever talked about actually covering this one. And so for me, it's definitely a buy because it is kind of like it's a good look at Tim Curry's work as an amazing fucking actor, and just watching deliver those oh so awesome lines of the
"Excuse me, ma'am, is your refrigerator running? It is. Well, you better catch it before it runs away."
You can only get so much amazingness with Tim Curry when he's spouting off cheesy lines like that. But no, that movie is definitely a buy for me. Even though there are, especially whenever the adults, it is really slow, like we were saying earlier. But if you can get past that, it's for me, it's definitely a buy.
Sweet.
What about you guys?
I don't know.
Go ahead there, Jefferson.
All right, let me just get real.
As he crashes through his homemade castle of beer bottles.
I know. I was like, I remember my first.
And if hurricane ain't gonna flood this.
I know. I remember my first six pack of beer. You know, I had fun going back and rewatching the original TV movie because, like y'all said, the original stuff when they're kids, it's done perfect. Tommy Lee Wallace, he did his job. I mean, I know we would later go on to appreciate Frank Darabont for touching Stephen King's work, like The Green Mile or Shawshank and stuff like that. But for what Tommy Lee Wallace was given and the way TV movies were handled, it's one of the better ones. You know, I do enjoy going back and watching Storm of the Century or Rose Red or Tommyknockers, but yeah, it is always going to be on the top of my list for TV movies that I like to go back and, you know, spend 3 hours watching. You can go on Amazon and order the Blu-ray for $7.99. Unfortunately, it is still captured at the 4:3 ratio, which is the old school TV format. There's not really a wide aspect ratio of this that was filmed. The ensemble for the kids is incredibly strong, and Tim Curry's elements that he brings to it are incredibly creepy, eerie, unique when he takes on the leper or the werewolf creature or all these different variants of the It. They're done well. And I mean, the only thing that disconnects you is the 50s is the give and take between the adults and the kids' viewpoints. But all in all, it's a good three plus hour movie. You know, it's fun. It's not something I'd rewatch over and over again, but it's nice to revisit because it's solid beginning to end. A&E cheese, you know, all the way through and through. But the book is fun. The book I couldn't recommend more. If you like a good horror / fantasy novel, it is a good place to be. It's a long it's a long piece. I'm not going to lie to you. It's that's the reason I don't read the Game of Thrones novels, because I just don't like the POV shit. But as King has gone on as a writer, I'm glad I appreciate more of his current novels a little bit more than I do going back to some of his older shit. But going back to the old novel, you know what? Having the paperback, I do knock away, you know, 60 to 90 pages, you know, every hour, you know, when I sit down and just kind of get into it, you know, and chill out. But it's been a tough read. I'm halfway through it with the reread, because I was trying to reread it before we caught the remake. But it's been fun. You know, I'm not thrilled to be rereading it, but, you know, it's something I've been keeping in my fucking truck. You know, whenever I do have a break here and there, I'll put some fucking pages down. But all in all, you know what? $7.99, you can't go wrong on Amazon. It'd be an easy buy for me, especially today. Yeah, that's kind of my feelings on the original TV movie. How about you, Nate?
Right on. Shit, I couldn't agree more. I really like the book. As far as the miniseries goes, you know, I've been pretty vocal saying that the younger part of it is the best part of it.
Totally.
And that's the first, I mean, I guess, what, hour and a half? Something around there is the first, is the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I highly recommend that. Way high. I'm talking like probably an 8.5 out of 10. Like, I love that whole segment. But then when it gets into the older version, it kind of drops to almost like a 4 or a 5. Like, I don't enjoy it. I don't like the main actor who's playing Bill. The only person I like out of the adults is John Ritter. So, I mean, I'm gonna go ahead and give this a buy, because I think it's important. I think it's one of Tim Curry's very best moments on film. But know that last hour and a half is gonna fucking lull you to sleep. But yeah, I can't wait to see what comes down the turnpike, and I want to know I can't wait till this new It comes out. I want to see where they're gonna go, if they're gonna be more faithful to the book with the turtle and the universe building, or if they're just gonna stay straight as a scary clown movie. I'm hoping for somewhere in between the middle. That's honestly where I'm at. So, yeah, that'd be where I come. You know, fucking 8.5 for the first one, first part. Second part, probably like a 4.
Gotcha.
Okay. I can get behind that.
So as we come nearer and draw nearer to the theatrical release of It, fucking, we're going to try to survive the hurricane, take some canoes and jet skis up to the theater, and check this fucking thing out. Well, on that, I'm Nathan.
I'm Jeff.
And this is Ralph.
Keep it dry and keep it scary.
Don't keep it too dry. I mean, you got to have some moisture.
We really do have to get going. Wait, where do we keep the moisture?
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplanes.
Yeah,
Mini Bruce is
you get a dry beat.
Oh, yeah. Your cellmate's not going to like you.
Oh, I always leave mine behind.
In
you go, Sally.
In the behind.
Fuck off.
Yikes.
All right, listeners. Glad to be here again. And see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Deep in the Horror of Texas. Be sure to like and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, please leave a review on the iTunes or Stitcher radio app. And above all, remember to keep it scary.